Thanks for tuning in to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thirst for More podcast was created to help strength and conditioning coaches, personal trainers, fitness enthusiasts, and anyone that loves lifting heavy shit all be connected under one roof. We take deep dives into coaching, programming and training, running gyms, nutrition, and overall improving your knowledge in the field of strength and conditioning. If you're new here, I'm glad you're able to tune in and hope you can just take away one awesome piece of information today to help you along with your journey. If you're a returning supporter, I appreciate you being along for the ride. Now let's dive into today's episode. Welcome back to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley, and today's episode is different because I'm talking to two audiences here simultaneously. So first off, if you're a strength coach, personal trainer, or gym owner working with young athletes, this is going to be for you. But I'm also speaking directly to parents who have kids in travel sports or are considering whether to go down that road. Both of you need to hear the same information because the disconnect between what coaches know and what parents understand is creating problems for kids caught in the middle here. So let me paint a brief picture here that both groups will probably recognize very well. Parents, you're spending somewhere between $5,000 and $15,000 per year on your kid's travel team. You're driving hours every weekend for tournaments. Your child is practicing year-round in a single sport. You're doing this because you love your kid, but you want to give them also opportunities, and everyone else seems to be doing it as well. Coaches, the same kid walks into your facility showing movement dysfunction, overuse injuries, burnout symptoms, and you're trying to figure out how to help them with undermining the parents' investment or the sport coach's program. Both of you want what's best for the young athlete, but you're often working from completely different ideas and playbooks here. So today, I'm going to look at what the research actually tells us about youth travel sports, what's working, what's broken, and how coaches and parents can get on the same page to actually serve these kids for the better being of them. Because here's the actual truth. The youth travel system isn't going anywhere anytime soon, but we can all do better within that system and ultimately do what's best for the athlete and child and do our due diligence to make sure that we're providing them the right step forward. So let me start by giving both coaches and parents here the bigger picture, because understanding where we are requires knowing how we actually got here. Youth travel sports, also usually commonly called club sports or sometimes select sports, have fundamentally transformed over the past 20 years. These are organized competitive teams that practice year-round. They travel regionally, sometimes even nationally for tournaments, and require significant financial and time investment from both the families and the coaches. Now, according to the Aspen Institute Project Play Initiative, which has done the most comprehensive research on youth sports in America, approximately 21.5 million children between the ages of 6 to 17 participate in team sports. Of these kids, roughly 20% of them are involved in travel or competitive-based club sports. So some quick math here, that's over 4 million kids in this system. And if you're a parent hearing these numbers, you're probably nodding because you see this explosion firsthand at the fields, the gyms, every single weekend while you're training. But here's the number that should get everyone's attention. Youth sports market in the United States is estimated at approximately $19 billion annually. $19 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars. So for parents, that's not just your tournament fees and your uniforms. That's the private coaching, the specialized training facilities, sports psychology-based services, physical therapy, nutrition counseling. Entire industries built around servicing this massive now ecosystem. So coaches, whether you realize it or not, your gym or your training business is likely part of this supply chain. And, you know, I'm guilty for that. And understanding that the economics help explain the pressures that we're navigating with families as coaches. Now, the growth has been pretty staggering, and the research published in the Journal of Athletic Training shows us exactly how dramatic this is. Between 2000 and 2020, overall youth sports participation remained relatively stable, but the intensity and specialization within that participation increased massively. So there's a big push for single sport specialization among youth athletes, under the age of 14, an increase from approximately 30% in the year 2000 to over 70% by 2020 in some areas of the United States. So think about that shift alone. In one generation, we went from most kids playing multiple sports to most kids focusing exclusively on just one sport before they even get into high school. Now, what might be driving this? And parents, I want you to understand these forces because they're affecting your decision-making, whether you realize it or not. So first, there's the professionalization of college recruiting. College coaches now identify and recruit at younger ages, creating pressure for early specialization and high-level competition. You've seen 13-year-olds with recruiting profiles and social media highlight reels because the system has pushed recruitment younger and younger. Second, there's been massive commercialization where private organizations have replaced many community-based recreation programs. The free or low-cost local league got replaced by the expensive club team with professional coaching and travel schedules. Number three, and I'm just being honest here, there's what researchers call opportunity hoarding among upper middle class families, where parents view sports as a vehicle for college scholarships, social capital, and even resume building. So coaches, you're seeing this result of the forces in your facility every day. If you're like me, I see this every single day. And the families walking through your doors are responding to real pressures in a landscape that has very quickly changed. And our job is to help them navigate it with better information to the best of our ability. So now let's kind of talk about what the research actually is telling us about youth athletic development, because this is where we need coaches and parents hearing the exact same information. Okay, I've kind of beat this in a horse in years past. That's why I'm also touching on it again today. But the gap between what the science shows and what travel sports culture promotes is enormous. And kids are paying the price for that gap. So the American Academy of Pediatrics, along with virtually every major sports medicine organization out there, recommends against single sport specialization before adolescence. Their clinical report on sports specialization in young athletes is pretty clear here. They recommend that children participating in multiple sports until at least age 15 to 16, with specific guidelines suggesting that young athletes should take at least 1 to 2 days off per week from organized sports and take 2 to 3 months off per year from any individual specific sport. So think about people that you might know and maybe the sports they play, or if they happen to be the one-trick pony athlete, if they're listening to these guidelines. I even get pushback when I talk to baseball players, specifically pitchers, when they talk about throwing year-round and how that they need to take several months off to give their shoulder not only adequate rest and recovery, but to try different sports, try different movement patterns, maybe get in a strength and conditioning facility and strengthen that shoulder up and the muscles around it, you know, actually mature and actually also just enjoy being a kid. I think that's also incredibly important for me, these kids at this age. Now, parents, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, but my kid's teammate who specialized early is getting college looks. My kid will fall behind if they take time off. Everyone else is training year-round. So it's keeping up with the Joneses, basically. And I hear what you're saying, and we're going to address those concerns directly. But first, both coaches and parents understand why these recommendations exist, because they're grounded in serious developmental-based science. They're not just theoretical preferences and that we're trying to just spew this out of nowhere. It's actually backed by a lot of research and science. So from a physical development perspective, the research is pretty clear here. That a study published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine found that younger athletes who specialized in a single sport were 70 to 93% more likely to be injured than children who played multiple sports. That's not like a small percentage. 70 to 93%. That is a lot. That's 7 to 9 kids out of every single 10 that you see. That's your kid being almost twice as likely to get hurt as the kid that's not specializing in one individual sport. And coaches, this is why you're seeing more young athletes with overuse injuries that you historically probably only saw more so in the professional athletes, maybe even in the college ranks, who'd been training for decades. And I know that I'm personally seeing this uptick since I have opened my gym in 2018. Now, the physiology behind this makes sense when you actually understand skeletal development. So young athletes have growth plates, developing bones, and connective tissues that are more vulnerable to repetitive stress than actual adult tissues. So when a 12-year-old pitcher throws year-round with no break, or a young soccer player does the same cutting and sprinting movements 52 weeks in a year, those repetitive forces on developing structures create injury risk. Research from the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine shows that overuse injuries now account for nearly half of all sports injuries in middle and high school students, and these injuries are strongly correlated with single sport specialization in year-round training. Now, we're talking about stress fractures in shins and feet, tendinopathies in the shoulders, knees, growth plate-based injuries, chronic pain conditions in children. Okay, I see these are things that I've all seen personally. And parents, these are not minor bumps and bruises. These are injuries that can actually require surgery, lengthy rehabilitation time, and sometimes even in athletic careers before they even really even get the chance to start. And coaches, you're often the one identifying these injuries before parents fully realize the actual severity of what's going on. So you need to know the research to have those difficult conversations. But the physical injuries are only part of the story here. From a motor development and overall athleticism standpoint, the research shows that multi-sport participation leads to better long-term athletic development than early specialization. A landmark study examining the developmental pathways of elite athletes across multiple sports found that the vast majority of Olympians and professional athletes participated in multiple sports during childhood and didn't specialize until their mid to late teens. Now, you might be thinking, is this just correlation? And it's important for both audiences to understand because I kind of hear you here. But during childhood and early adolescence, the nervous system is building fundamental movement patterns, developing body awareness and coordination, and creating a diverse motor skill base. So playing multiple sports exposes young athletes to varied movement demands, different energy systems, and diverse physiological changes that create a broader athletic foundation. The basketball player benefits from soccer's endurance and footwork demands. The baseball player benefits from football's power and agility and development. The volleyball player benefits from the basketball's jumping and spatial awareness and training and doing different movement patterns. So parents, here's what this means from a practicality standpoint. When your kid plays multiple sports, they're not falling behind, I promise you. They're actually building a more complete athletic foundation that will serve them better in the long run, including their primary sport. And coaches, this is the framework that you can use to help parents understand that the training you're advocating isn't just undermining the child's sport-specific development, but it actually will enhance it over the big picture, right? We got to think big picture here, and I think too many people don't look at that big picture. Now let's talk about something that often gets overlooked on the focus of physical development and performance, and that's the psychological impact of youth travel sports and the culture that has created from all this. This matters tremendously to both coaches and parents, even though it shows up differently in each of your experiences. So research published in the Journal of Clinical Sports Psychology has documented what they call athlete burnout in children as young as 10 years old. 10 years old, athletes are getting burnout. That's completely unacceptable. So parents, let me be very direct with you. We're seeing clinical burnout symptoms, the same kind of burnout that affects adults in high-stress careers in elementary school children. So the burnout in these youth athletes shows up as reduced sense of accomplishment, emotional and physical exhaustion, and devaluation of the sport that they actually used to love. The research identifies three primary contributors to the youth athlete burnout phenomenon that we're seeing, and both coaches and parents need to understand these. So first is the sheer volume and intensity of training and competition without adequate recovery. Number two is going to be the external pressure from parents, coaches, and the culture around achieving results and actually winning competitions, maybe especially when winning the competitions doesn't really matter at some of these ages. And third is the loss of autonomy and intrinsic motivation when sports stop being something kids choose to do for enjoyment and become an obligation driven by external expectations. Again, going back to whether that's the parent expectations, the coach expectations, or even maybe trying to fit into social groups when we talk about hanging out with friends and having their identity on their Instagram, that they're XYZ athlete at school or what position or who they're being recruited by, right? And so here's a statistic that should stop everyone and just give us all a brief pause and really kind of think that a longitudinal study tracking youth athletes over 5 years found that approximately 70% of children who participate in organized sports quit before the age of 13. That is crazy. 7 in 10 kids are going to quit sports by the age of 13. So parents, you really need to understand that the pressure that you're putting on them, think about this, that you, if they like it, you want them to continue to like it. You don't want them to quit. So do everything you can to support them to playing that sport and staying involved, not putting necessarily the pressure on them to do well. So 70% dropout rate by age 13. That's pretty crazy. And the primary reasons that are cited aren't the lack of ability or the interest in just the sport itself. The reasons are that it's no longer fun. There's too much pressure. And the time commitment conflicts with other interests for normal childhood development. So if we think about what this means, parents, you're investing thousands of dollars and countless hours driving to practices and tournaments, often with the hope that this leads to college opportunities or at a minimum, continued participation in a sport that your child loves. But 7 out of 10 kids are going to quit before they even get to high school. And it's often because the system has made something they loved into something they end up beginning to dread. And coaches, you're seeing these burned out kids in your facilities if you're like me. And part of our job is helping identify the warning signs and then communicate them to the parents before the child completely checks out and decides to throw by the wayside. Now, from a developmental psychology perspective, this is important because just sports participation alone is important, right? And there's a lot of great things from kids just playing sports and just being involved, okay? We're not talking about even the competitive side and everything else, just everything that sports provide, both physically, mentally, socially, right? There's so many great things and life lessons that come from sports outside of looking at even just the physical side of things. Now, childhood and adolescence are critical periods for identity formation, social skill development, and building intrinsic motivation. So when sports become highly structured, they're externally driven, and achievement-focused activities dominated by adult agendas rather than the child directly play and exploration of doing what they want to do, they can actually undermine healthy psychological development rather than support it. So we really want to try to focus on the psychology side that is going to do other stuff that, hey, it's probably actually going to help them in school and their career. And, you know, 20 years later, those are some of the benefits that we see from sports. Now, the social dynamics within travel sports culture creates additional psychological challenges. Research has documented that increased anxiety among youth athletes related to performance pressure, fear of disappointing parents and coaches, and constant social comparison with teammates and competitors. Parents, your kid might not be telling you how anxious they feel before games or how much stress they are experienced around performance-based expectations, but research shows that these psychological burdens are real and common in the average athlete. So communicating with your kid is also going to be incredibly important, because having a two-way conversation where saying you're going to go do this, maybe giving them the opportunity to choose to do a sport, especially when they're really young, right? I think it's okay to have your child experience a sport. Hey, we're going to try soccer and see how this goes. And if you don't like it at the end of the season, we never have to play it again. That's a much better conversation than saying you're going to do soccer and we're going to keep doing it. And then your kid doesn't get an actual option or voice. Okay, I do somewhat support putting your kids in different things because they may not know whether they like it or not, right? I mean, they're going to be biased towards what you watch or what you see or what you like because they want to look up to mom and dad. But exposing them to other sports that maybe they're not typically exposed to could make them find something that they're actually really passionate about that you would have never known if you didn't subject them to that. So it's a fine line. There has to be a communication, even with the child. I know they're a child and you're the adult in the room, but you need to communicate with your child here. There's also this phenomenon that researchers have labeled sideline rage and parent-coach conflicts that create toxic environments. I'm sure you've seen this on social media. I know I see them all the time. So parents, I'm going to be really blunt and honest with you here. Some of the behavior happening at these youth sporting events is damaging to kids. The yelling at referees, the criticism of their coaches, the pressure placed on children to perform, and the way some parents process wins and losses creates an environment where sports become a source of stress rather than a source of joy and growth. They should be in this for fun, number one. And if you are making it not fun for them, that is, as it says, I'm not a huge fan of the word toxic, but that is a toxic environment. yelling at the refs, yelling at their coach, complaining about playing time, making a scene, yelling from the stands, throwing stuff. We even see fights. The shit's just unacceptable. That's just all there is to it. Now, coaches, this is where we can play a really important role, because many of the young athletes coming to us are carrying significant psychological weight around their sport and their performance. And so they may have developed these perfectionist-based tendencies, or maybe they've got fear of failure or motivation systems that are entirely external rather than internal. And so our coaching environment can be a place where they can experience sports and training differently, where they build intrinsic motivation, where mistakes are learning opportunities rather than failures, and where their worth isn't tied directly to the performance-based outcome. So the thing that I love, and I've been very honest about this in the past, that I love about strength and conditioning is that it rewards people that just work hard. You don't have to be the most athletic person, right? You don't have to be the smartest person. You know, we just put weight on the bar or do movements, and you can very quickly see progress as weights increase, or you're doing the same weight for more reps, or maybe you're able to get through sets easier because you're in better shape, or maybe you're actually noticing that you're faster because you're working on your mechanics. These are all great things that build confidence in athletes, and we work with more female athletes than we do guys, and I see this on a very consistent basis, is that girls see a huge benefit because they build confidence. They're jumping on boxes they never did, or they're lifting weights that they never thought, or maybe when they started, they never thought they would touch, and now they're doing it for reps, right? That builds confidence, and that intrinsic confidence of them learning to kind of push themselves by themselves, because, I mean, we try to get kids to increase their weight and do their job, and we give them goals and milestones on some of their programs. They've got to get a certain weight on certain exercises, but we also want them to find that intrinsic motivation to do it, because once they kind of get a little bit of a bug, then they really kind of dive in and go after it. And sometimes for sports, that can be a little bit harder because you're comparing yourself to everybody else, where in the weight room, you only have to compare yourself to yourself, and are you getting better? And it's much more visibly tangible, especially if you track your training like you're supposed to. All right, next section. Let's talk about some of the economics of youth travel sports, because this affects both the coaches and parents in direct and in pretty significant ways. And this can be an uncomfortable conversation, but it's necessary for understanding the pressures and the dynamics that are at play here with types of travel sports. So again, research from the Aspen Institute's Project Play reports that families with household incomes above $75,000 are twice as likely to have children participating in team sports compared to families with household incomes below $25,000. But when we look specifically at travel sports, the economic stratification becomes even more dynamic. Now, I know those are some pretty big glaring numbers there, but the money does kind of matter to extent. You can't do travel sports if you can't pay for it, right? And so parents, the average cost for having one child participate in travel sports can range anywhere from $2,000 to over $15,000 per year, depending on the sport and the level of the competition. That's going to include your tournament fees, your coaching fees, your travel expenses for the hotels, the gas, the equipment, uniforms, and any kind of other associated costs outside of that. For certain sports like ice hockey or club volleyball or competitive gymnastics, annual costs can exceed $20,000, and that's absolutely insane. That's absolutely insane. We're talking about mortgage payments every single month to be able to play a club sport. And so if you have multiple children in travel sports, you're potentially spending as much on youth athletics as many families spend on their housing and their gas and their food, right? Just to be able to live, you're spending almost just as much money when it comes to having multiple athletes or multiple kids doing these. And so this creates pretty several important dynamics that both audiences need to understand here, both parents and coaches. For parents, this represents a massive financial investment in your child's development, and it's completely natural to want to see returns on that investment. The problem is that viewing youth sports primarily as an investment with expected returns, whether that's college scholarships or professional-based opportunities, creates pressure that can be counterproductive to actual healthy development of your child. And so let me give you some context here on college scholarships, because this is often stated and sometimes even unstated for the main driving goal of travel sports participation is that college scholarship, especially now when we talk about the implementation of name, image, and likeness, especially with football and somewhat basketball. And I have a feeling it's going to trickle to even more sports over time. But the NCAA reports that less than 2% of high school athletes receive any athletic scholarship money for college, and fluoride scholarships are even more rare. Now, numbers are based on athletic scholarships, so this is not scholastic-based or academic-based, like getting academic-based scholarships. These are the athletic, for being the athlete, right? Okay? You got to make sure you understand the difference there. Once you start factoring some of the academic stuff, those percentages jump up higher, which is why we try to preach to kids to have good GPAs and take their school seriously, because it's much easier to get recruited because the universities can find that funding through academic ways to help get you on the roster as well. Not that I'm going to say that that's something you should bank on, but outside of your kids just putting good effort in school, it can increase their opportunities to doing collegiate athletics. But the athletic scholarship money side of it just by itself is less than 2% of high school athletes getting that quote unquote academic or athletic based money, excuse me. So the average athletic scholarship, when one is awarded, covers only portions sometimes of the cost. So when you do the math on spending $10,000 per year for 8 years of travel sports, it'd be $80,000 versus the likelihood and the average value of the athletic scholarship, the financial investment often doesn't make much economic sense. Now, I'm not saying that youth sports participation should only be about the financial return on the investment. Sports obviously provide value through skill development, discipline, teamwork, goal setting, physical health, social connections. But parents, if the primary justification for the financial strain in your life is the hope of a college scholarship for your child, you need to understand the actual probabilities and actually have some realistic expectations here. And for coaches, understanding this economic pressure is critical to your work with the families. So when a parent is spending $10,000 per year on their child's travel team and then adding our training services on top of that, they're making a significant financial commitment. And so this creates expectations around results, progress, and outcomes that you need to be able to navigate professionally. So our job is to help parents understand that appropriate development training may not look what they expect, especially if their expectations are shaped by the quote unquote win now culture of travel sports rather than the long-term athletic development principles. And as a coach and professional, and I'm sure if you are a coach or professional as well, you understand this, that getting parents to understand that performance-based training is more after the long-term athletic development side. We're looking at the big picture, and this needs to ideally be a longer-term investment, right? It's not something that you go do strength and conditioning or performance-based training for 3 or 6 months and you never return back to it. If that college scholarship or that college opportunity is a real interest of both the parent, more so the kid than anybody else, but also the parent, then dumping just 3 months here and 3 months here and 3 months here is almost more of a waste of your time and money than it is of just saying, hey, we're going to do this for the next 3-4 years to make sure that we're ready, right? That's a different outcome because it's going to stack the wins and stack the progress over time. Now, there's also the equity issue that both coaches and parents should consider here. So the financial barriers to travel sports participation means that talented young athletes from lower income families are increasingly excluded from the high level competition based opportunities. And this isn't just only technically like kind of an ethical concern. I'm not going to try to get the ethics of it, but it arguably could be. But it also means that the talent pool in travel sports is artificially limited by economics rather than the actual athletic potential. So coaches, if you're running a gym or training facility, working with athletes, thinking about how to create accessible pathways for youth athletic development, regardless of family incomes, it actually is something worth considering. This is something I've tried to consider, is how can I provide a service that is a little bit more economically friendly, but still provide athletes the opportunity to get better just because they can't afford it. And so parents understanding that the system is economically, stratified from might inform of how you think about the culture values being modeled in the travel sports environment. So this is where doing the group sessions and bringing the training down, or doing team-based work, or just a sport-specific session, right? Or clumping together some age groups to bring the prices down may not only be better from a business perspective as a performance coach, but also making it a better opportunity for the athletes and making it more financially realistic for the parents so that we're not feeding into this culture even worse. Now, let's talk about the most contentious question probably in youth athletics, and this is where coaches and parents often find themselves on opposite sides. And the question is whether kids should specialize in a single sport at young ages or participate in multiple sports through childhood and adolescence. And we both populations, both parents and coaches, need to understand the nuance here, because the answer isn't as simple as the travel sports culture makes it seem to believe. Now, the research consensus from sports medicine and athletic development science is pretty overwhelming. A systematic review published in Sports Health examining over 40 studies on youth sports specialization concluded that early specialization in a single sport increases injury risk and does not necessarily lead to better long-term performance outcomes. Studies tracking elite athletes across multiple sports consistently show that late specialization, typically in the mid to late adolescence, is the more common pathway to elite performance than early specialization. Now, for the parents, I know this contradicts what you're seeing and what you're hearing in the travel sports culture. You're watching kids who specialize early, making elite teams, getting recruited, and they seem to be succeeding. Meanwhile, the message from travel organizations often implies or explicitly states that if your child isn't specializing by 8, 9, 10 years old, they're going to fall permanently behind and lose their opportunity to compete at high levels. And this creates enormous pressure to specialize early when research suggests that it's actually counterproductive. These coaches and organizations are going to try to con you into that you got to be on this elite select level team that's playing year round. And if they don't do this, your kid is going to be behind. They're basically fear mongering you that your kid's not going to be able to do it. And the research says that it's counterproductive. Do not listen to those people. So here's what you need to understand about the actual specialization debate here. Okay, because this will probably always go on eternity when it comes to sports, but I do feel that it is getting a little bit better towards long-term athletic development. But the specialization that I'm seeing in kids still says that it's incredibly too high still. So the definition of specialization is really where we need to kind of start here. So the research distinguishes between sport-specific skill development and exclusive year-round participation in a single sport. So a young athlete can develop sport-specific skills and participate in competitive teams while still engaging in other sports and activities. The problematic pattern is when athletes train and compete in a single sport year-round to the exclusion of other physical activities and with no planned periods of rest or variation. Now, for coaches, this distinction is pretty critical for how you advise families and design your training programs. Because advocating against early specialization doesn't mean advocating against serious training or competitive participation in a primary sport. It means advocating for strategic periodization, involvement in complementary-based activities, and allowing for physical and psychological recovery through varied movement demands. And so this is where, me personally, if I find out that a kid is saying, I use baseball a lot as an example, so I'll stick with that. If we talk about baseball and a kid's playing baseball year-round, I always try to nudge them into trying other sports. Hey, are you going to play soccer? Are you going to play basketball? Are you going to wrestle? Are you going to run cross country? Right? Because the benefit of them doing that is not only just having a different sport, but if they do that other sport, that probably means they can't go do that other one. It's going to decrease their ability to pitch and hit and play baseball, right? There's going to be some conflicting things. They got to choose. And I think it's at the younger ages, that's tremendously important. But parents, you actually have to make sure that if they choose to run cross country, don't put them in a baseball tournament the next weekend or even the same day, okay? Give your kid a break and say, hey, you ran a 2K race today in middle school. You don't need to go play baseball. It's okay. Let your body recover. Go have fun. You did one hard athletic thing today. You've been training all week for this. Take it off, right? Don't worry about the baseball tournament, because guess what? The baseball in the fall at 12 years old isn't going to do shit for your kid's development, right? Maybe it's fun. Maybe they get a little blingy ring or whatever, but it's really, at the end of the day, in the big picture, it's not going to do anything to actually drive their development forward, where giving them that extra rest is going to let them psychologically and physiologically actually be able to recover and do something else and build a little bit of fire into them for them to be excited to get back to baseball in this example. And so I kind of want to talk about what this looks like from a practicality standpoint outside of what I just did. And this is what parents and coaches are on the same page here. This is what I'm trying to get. that a young basketball player might play the competitive basketball during the winter season, participate in soccer in the spring, and focus on general strength conditioning training during the summer. And so this provides a year-round athletic development without year-round single sport activity or repetitive sports stress. And so a baseball player might play baseball in the summer / spring, football in the fall, and dedicate their winter and their spring towards their strength, power, and movement quality development with a performance professional. So ideally is though they're not going to do the sport year-round. They can do it more frequently, but you still should be doing other stuff based upon the seasonality. And one of the best things that I've heard, I wish I could give credit to heard it from, I really do, is that the sport that's in season is the sport that you do. So cross country, for example, being a fall sport, if that's what you're doing, that's your fall sport, that's what you do. You don't play baseball. If it's winter, you don't play baseball. You play basketball or you wrestle or you swim, right? You do an indoor-based activity. And the spring, that's when you do baseball. And if you're doing travel ball, you can do your travel ball over the summer. And then you find somewhere to put in some strength conditioning-based training throughout that, ideally in one of the time that sports aren't as important. Winter's a great time for a lot of families to do that. It's when we kind of see an uptick ourselves, is we get more athletes typically in the winter because they're kind of limited to what they can do outside living here in Indiana. And so for coaches, it's really kind of critical on how you advise families and design training programs, right? So advocating against early specialization doesn't mean advocating against serious training or competitive participation in a primary sport. It means advocating for that strategic periodization, right? So parents, the concern that you probably have is whether this multi-sport approach means your child won't be skilled as the kids that are doing their primary sport 52 weeks out of the year. And so the research actually suggests the entire opposite, that the transfer of skills and physical qualities across sports combined with the reduced injury risk and better psychological sustainability of the multi-sport approach tends to lead to better long-term outcomes in the athlete's primary sport. So maybe they don't get as many swings in a year, but if they are a better athlete, they're psychologically better prepared, they're healthier because they're going to have reduced injury risk, right? If you're doing the same movement pattern over and over, your shoulder's bothering, your elbow's bothering, right? You're not getting the best return on investment out of those pitching lessons, those hitting lessons, or what have you, right? So, an injured athlete is useless when it comes to actually getting better. And we see that a lot is that athletes get injured and then they come to us and we have to get them back as quickly as they can. Well, ideally, if they would have came to us and played some different sports, they may have never been in that position earlier, right? We want to try to keep going up the stairs over time. We don't want to get sidelined, and specialization increases your risk of getting sidelined, especially when it comes to repetitive movements like throwing a baseball, for example. So we want to make sure that we're after the long-term outcomes, long-term, especially if this is something that you're actually after in college-based sports or something that's seriously on the table. Now, there are sport-specific considerations that add nuance. So there is some research suggesting that sports requiring peak performance before full physical maturity may benefit from earlier focused training. Gymnastics and figure skating are two that are very commonly cited here, where athletes may need a little more concentrated training earlier. Though, even though these sports typically have an earlier specialization, the evidence for the extremely early exclusive specialization is still mixed. You still should be a well-rounded general athlete, but you may have to just specialize a little earlier, especially when we talk about females and gymnastics, especially. Now, the critical concept that both coaches and parents need to embrace is what researchers call the practice-play continuum. Now, structured, deliberate practice is important for skill development. Nobody becomes elite at anything without focused, intentional practice. But free play, varied physical activity, and exploration are all equally important for overall athletic development, injury prevention, and psychological well-being. So the optimal balance between the deliberate practice and the varied play changes with age and the developmental stages, but the complete elimination of play and variation in favor of exclusive deliberate practice is counterproductive. Okay, you probably hear, maybe I'm trying to sound like an old head here, I always went outside and played. And kids today don't really go outside and play. They're glued to their cell phones. They're glued to their PlayStation or their Xbox or their computer or their iPad, right? They're more locked up inside, and their communicating and their social structures are and social communication is so much more online, where, you know, in my day, I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have the internet. Or if I did, you know, I got on AOL's Messenger. Hey, we'll meet up at this time, because you wouldn't be able to lock up the phone all the time, right? So doing things like riding your bikes and going and playing in the woods and playing some pickup basketball and football and all the things that we did as kids, that's that free range play. And kids are seeing a decrease in that now. And so that's where, unfortunately, my job becomes more important, is that I'm basically structured free range play. I'm providing those movement patterns and variabilities that kids aren't getting through free play, because they're not outside playing. And so you're having to pay somebody to be able to provide that, even though we do other things, obviously. But our kids still run, jump, and throw objects and squat and lunge and do things sideways. And, you know, those are all things that you get out of free play. And so just understand that you don't want to specialize, obviously. You don't want to have just a deliberate practice that's not your quote-unquote exercise or play. We want to find ways to help athletes and kids just be outside and be kids. That's the great thing about PE, and it's unfortunate that PE budgets and time continue to get cut in the education system, because that provides more free-range play for kids to have if that's built into the school day. Now, for coaches, our role is to often push back against the premature specialization while still supporting serious athletic development and respecting the family's goals for their child. Now, this requires a bit of diplomacy, clear communication, and the ability to articulate research in accessible ways. And that's kind of what this podcast episode is ideally trying to do here. Parents, your role is to consider whether the pressure that you're feeling to specialize early is coming from evidence about what's best for your child, or from the cultural pressure that travel sports has kind of stigmatized here, and fear that your child will be left behind when in actuality they're not going to be. Okay. Sixth part here. Let's talk directly to coaches here for a minute about specific strategies and skills that we need when working with young athletes in the travel sports system. And parents, I encourage you to listen here to this section as well, because understanding what your coach is doing and why will help you to work together more efficiently and have a better communication and help your child navigate this landscape a little bit better. So first, as coaches, you need to become skilled at movement screening and injury risk assessment specifically for youth athletes. So tools like the FMS or Young Physical Development Assessment Models can help you identify movement deficiencies, asymmetries, and injury risk factors. Now, I know some people get all bent out of shape with the FMS. It's not that practical. Just put them through a workout and see what they can and can't do. But for me personally, I like using pieces of the FMS because it's structured. I can put the same kids, the same test repetitively over and over, and I can strategically see progress over time. Or if they happen to go away for a while and they come back injured, I can see what might be the difference that wasn't there to begin with, right? I do like the structure of it. So whether you like the FMS or not, that's not what this episode is about. But many young athletes in travel sports are incredibly skilled at their specific sport, but have surprisingly poor fundamental movement quality. So a baseball player, for example, might have an elite swing, but can't properly squat or lunge. Something I see very commonly. Or maybe a soccer player might have great ball skills, but shows terrible landing mechanics that might put them at risk for an ACL injury, right? So our job is to identify these gaps and systematically work to address them. Now, number two, understanding the growth and maturation assessment. So two 13-year-old athletes can be at completely different stages of their biological development, which can have, you know, profound implications for their training programming, their injury risk, and the appropriate performance expectations. So tools like maturity can offset calculations and can help you program for individual development status rather than just their chronological age. So a late maturing 13-year-old and an early maturing 13-year-old should not be doing the exact same identical training programs, even if they're in the same competitive age group, they play the same sports, maybe they're even on the same team. And you can see this because if you put two of those kids side by side, you might have a kid that's almost 6 foot tall and you got another kid that's 5 foot tall. You have one kid that might weigh 110 pounds soaking wet. You might have another kid that's 160 pounds, right? There's different body structures. Some of them even get facial hair. Like, it's pretty crazy. I know I had friends in school that definitely matured way faster than I did. And personally, it's why I'm a fan of more of the individualized based training programs, because you can actually take this into account. It's pretty obvious. Now, number three is that you need to develop the communication skills to have difficult conversations with parents about the appropriate training volume, the intensity, and the developmental-based timelines. And this is an interpersonal skill that nobody really teaches in any kind of certification-based programs, but I think it's absolutely critical when it comes to talking to parents. And my wife has said, always said that, Brandon, you do such a better job of talking to parents and putting things into perspective. And it's because I've done it longer than she has. And I've helped coach youth athletes and do things. And I know, and parents don't take this a bad way, but I know what parents like to hear that's going to get them the results that they're thinking about. So how I talk to mom is going to be different to how I talk to dad, even though I know in my head what I'm doing from a training program is still going to be structurally sound, based primarily based on research, and what's really going to change between some of these kids is not going to be a whole lot different. But I need to make sure that they understand it, and their, you know, mom's understanding that things are going to be okay and their kid's going to be safe and the little girl's not going to get hurt. And for dad, they need to understand, hey, your kid's going to train hard, but we're not going to absolutely obliterate them because we don't need to do that. My job is to get them better, not destroy them. You know, those are tough conversations to have, but how you communicate those can get buy-in and ultimately get the athlete what they need so that you can be able to navigate those conversations from parent to child, and even to potentially sport coaches. And so we need to be able to articulate the research on the specialization and the injury risks in ways that are evidence-based, but also empathetic towards the parental concerns and the financial investments that these families are making. So when a parent comes to us wanting their 12-year-old to do heavy barbell training 6 days per week because they think it will give their kid the competitive advantage, we need to be able to explain why that's developmentally inappropriate without making the parent feel stupid or dismissed, right? Hey, your 12-year-old doesn't need to bar squat. Can we get there? Absolutely. Have I had 12-year-olds learn to front squat and deadlift and these things? Absolutely, I have. But again, if I can get the same results and build the movement patterns initially with a goblet squat or some different push-up variations and learning how to hinge, these are much more fundamental things that are going to do better than trying to just immediately get my kid to deadlift. And nothing frustrates me more than when I see like 11, 12, or 13-year-old kid deadlifting on social media and it looks like absolute shit. It's very clear that whoever trained this kid did not do the proper steps of teaching the kid how to move properly first before going to load the movement pattern. Right? We have to look at the big picture here. The goal is for the kid to not deadlift a shit ton. The goal is for the kid to move better and play a sport better. If the process happens to yield a kid deadlifting a shit ton and doing that at the same time by the time they're in high school, that's fantastic. Yes, we've had several of our athletes deadlift in the 500s. That's awesome. I love to see stuff like that. But they didn't start off doing that. They start off learning how to hinge. Okay? So we got to make sure that we can have those conversations and help parents understand that, hey, we got to walk before we can run, and we got to take our time, and we will get better. Just you got to give us a little bit of room to be able to get there. We don't need to force feed certain things, because chances are they saw that 12 or 13-year-old deadlifting on social media and it didn't do shit for the kid's actual progress. Okay. Number four is that we got to think systematically about the periodization and recovery for these young athletes who are likely getting, one, inadequate recovery in their sports-specific based training, but also, two, they're probably not eating well enough, and they're also probably not sleeping well enough. So our strength and conditioning programming can't just pile more volume and intensity onto an already overtrained athlete or under-recovered athlete. You might need to focus primarily on, again, going to the movement quality, address the specific deficiencies that we're seeing, build general work capacity, because a lot of kids have really, really bad general work capacity. They just get out of shape super easily. I'm working with a softball team, and on day one, that's the first thing I saw. These kids are not in shape. So adjust the programming a little bit to where we're doing a little more conditioning stuff at the end to try to get their GPP up, try to get them ready, because I've only got about maybe 3 months to try to get these girls ready for their softball season. And if I don't get them in shape block one, block two and three are going to be a strain. So, you know, focusing on work capacity for a lot of kids is a big thing that's really missing. And probably a lot of kids can just focus on getting in better general physical preparedness, just being able to go run or whatever, and we'll see better progress because they can recover better. But we also need to sometimes provide lower intensity training sessions that can allow for active recovery from the sport demands rather than adding to the total stress. And for me personally, this is where talking to the athletes is important, because you can tell when a kid walks in, they're beat up, they're tired, maybe they even communicate that they are. We back off a little bit. Hey, we're going to bump some of the volume down a little bit. We're going to do a few sets here, a few sets less here. We're going to swap this exercise out because it's less eccentric and demanding than this one, right? You pivot your programming a little bit based on what the kid's telling you. And sometimes parents may have a hard time understanding that, but our job is, again, to get them better first. And sometimes that might mean our training sessions now become active recovery. And that really stinks, but if it moves the needle forward at the end of the day, that's what we're after. We're not trying to dig them a further ditch. All right, number five is that we're going to create coaching environments that support psychological health and intrinsic motivation. So many young athletes in travel sports are dealing with the performance anxiety we've talked about, the extra pressure, the fear of failure. And so our training sessions can be places where they can experience autonomy, where effort and process are valued over just the outcomes, and where the mistakes are treated as learning opportunities, and where they remember that training and sports can be challenging and enjoyable simultaneously. That's ultimately what I really like, and what we try to do with our program at Thirst, is making sure that the training is enjoyable and challenging at the same time. If they are having a great time, we will get better long-term buy-in and work ethic. If they hate it, they've come and they're gone. And it really stinks, and it really, really stinks when you can tell that this is the parents' idea to get them in there, rather more so than in them actually being interested and, again, having some of that intrinsic motivation. Okay, now from the last sections. And so now I'm going to kind of speak just a little bit more towards the parents for a couple minutes. And coaches, listening to this section can help you understand some questions or concerns that parents are dealing with, which can make you more effective in your communication skill with them. So parents, the first thing I want you to do is get really honest with yourself about your goals and your motivation for your child's sports participation. Are you pursuing travel sports because your child is passionate about the sport and has expressed clear goals that maybe require a level of competition that you're trying to get them in with travel sports? Or are you pursuing it because other families are doing it and you're worried that your child will be left behind? Okay, that's the first thing that you got to ask yourself. Because are you hoping for the college scholarship as a return on investment? Or are you living vicariously through your child's athletic-based achievements? Because these are uncomfortable questions, but answering them honestly is critical to making good decisions for your child. Don't try to shove this to them to do it for you. If it's something that they're passionate about and they have expressed that interest and they have kind of came to you and it's a conversation that's been had, 100%, I'm way more for all this stuff than I am if a child's like, I don't want to do this, but mom and dad are making me, right? I totally get it. I want nothing but the best for my son whenever it comes to athletics, when his time comes for that. He's obviously too young now. But still, even when we're in the gym and I see my kid picking up a kettlebell and trying to emulate us with dumbbells, or, you know, climbing on plyo boxes, he thinks he's jumping on the plyo box like mom and dad are. Like, that makes me incredibly happy. But I'm not going to say, Atlas, we're going to go do some kettlebell deadlifts today at 1.5 years old. That's absolutely ridiculous. And the same thing goes when they're 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, okay? Don't make them go do something. So really ask yourself those hard questions. Why are you interested in this, and what are the goals and motivations that you have for your kids' sports and athletic endeavors? Now, if college scholarships are a significant part of this equation and balance that you're trying to figure out, understand what the actual probabilities and the economics are. So like I said, less than 2% of high school athletes are receiving any kind of athletic scholarship funding. And so the average scholarship, when they actually get it, usually only covers those partial college costs. So if you're spending those $10,000 per year for 8 years on the travel sports like we talked about in hope of that scholarship return, you're spending $80,000 chasing a statistically unlikely outcome, right? That same $80,000 invested either in a college savings account or however you choose to invest it would provide substantially more certain educational-based funding. And I'm not saying that sports participation should only be about the financial return, definitely not. But if finances are tight and the scholarship hope is driving the investment, then you need to talk about some realistic expectations here of what actually might happen. And number two, you want to pay attention to your child's actual experience, not just their performance outcomes. So when you're watching your kid, is your child still genuinely enjoying their sport? Or have they started dreading actually going to the practices and games? Are they choosing to play or practice on their own time, or are they only doing it when it's required? Are they talking about their sport with excitement, watching it on TV, really kind of bought into sport, or are they discussing it and doing things with it with a little bit of stress and they feel like there's some obligation behind it? Are they experiencing chronic fatigue, persistent soreness or injuries, noticing that those things that they're constantly saying, I'm tired, or they're having a hard time getting up in the morning, or they're dreading going to school and seeing friends, right? These are warning signs that the current approach may not be serving your child as well as you think, regardless of what level team that they have made or how many games they happen to win. Because there are different levels now, and people talk about the wins and all that kind of stuff. That stuff doesn't matter, right? Pay attention to your child's body language and how they're interacting with you. Number three, we want to resist the pressure to specialize early just because that's what other families, friends are doing and what the club organization is pushing on you. The research is clear that multi-sport participation until mid-adolescence leads to better long-term athletic outcomes, lower injury rates, and better psychological well-being for your child. This is proven by research. So your child playing multiple sports isn't falling behind. Don't let somebody sell you on that. They're building a more complete athletic and developmental foundation. If a club, coach, organization tells you that your child must quit all their sports and commit exclusively to their program at age 10, that should be a major, major red flag about that organization's priorities and what they're actually in it for. They do not care about your kid. They care about, number one, getting your money, and number two, they're going to say, well, we're going to get paid to potentially have this kid go on to maybe make the MLB or the college, and then we can flaunt that kid that this is what our program did. But at the end of the day, it 99% chance did not have anything to do whether your kid actually made it onto that college scholarship or that professional organization later on in their careers. Number four, we want to build a relationship with your child's strength coach, personal trainer, and listen to their developmental expertise. Chances are, if you're around a good performance coach, you've done your due diligence and finding somebody that actually knows what the hell they're talking about, they have the knowledge about athletic-based development, especially the long-term aspect of it, the injury prevention side, and the appropriate training progressions that complements what sport coaches actually know and do. So that when your strength coach suggests reducing training volume, taking time off, or even addressing movement quality issues, they're not just being soft or undermining your child's competitiveness or willingness to be better or dedicatedness or whatever you want to underline or state that. Your performance coach or trainer is there actually applying developmental-based science and research to help protect your child's long-term health and athletic potential. I assure you that a good performance coach will have your child's interest first. They will care about what your child gets from an injury perspective, their long-term athletic development. We want every kid that we come to have a college scholarship. That would be insane, right? Like, that would be an insane statistic that, hey, every kid that comes training at Thirst ends up going and playing college. I would love that, but that's never going to happen. But it doesn't mean that's not what we want for them if that's what the kid wants. If that kid's like, hey, I want to play college baseball or softball or basketball, whatever, I want that for that kid. I want that kid to get money to help them get their education paid for. I want them to have those opportunities and those experiences and those social networks to help set them up for the rest of their life. Because if the performance training can help get them that, that's fantastic. That puts them ahead of other people. It makes them more hireable. It makes them better damn people, right? Good performance coaches want that. We're not in it for us. Performance coaches get no love generally. We're used to like not getting shout outs and not getting invited to stuff. And like, we're used to that stuff. We don't care about that. We care about the kid going on and doing other stuff. And that's great. And that creates long-term relationships with them. That's really ultimately what we're after. So make sure that when we as coaches and performance coaches and trainers say, hey, we're going to reduce time off, or we should back off, or we should decrease our frequency, or your kid should go do another sport this time of year, we're not saying it to like undermine you as a parent. We're saying it because we believe that's what's probably the best interest of your child's development. Now, we can't say what's best for your kid because we're not their parent. You ultimately are going to make that decision. but we're just going to try to educate you on what we know is generally best from a developmental side. All right, number five is that we want to actually make sure that we create space for your child's life for things other than their primary sport, right? Time with their friends outside of sports, involvement in other activity like music and arts, unstructured free time, adequate sleep, and family time, having dinners together, playing movies, watching movies, playing games together with your family. That time should not be dominated by sports schedules all just to be able to try to make a travel sport team or go on and get a college scholarship. We know that these other activities outside of sports are critical for just overall having a healthy child and healthy development. The research on the burnout shows that when sports become the only identity and the only thing valued in their child's activity in their life, the psychological problems often follow. All right, let's move to this other section here, section eight, that I want to discuss. And so let's bring everybody together here, both coaches and parents, if you're listening, because I think this is the important message of this entire podcast episode, and that coaches and parents need to be aligned in working collaboratively for the benefit of young athletes and for parents and child. So coaches, parents are making significant financial and time investments into their child's athletic development, often while navigating the cultural pressures and conflicting information about what is best for their child. They need us as coaches to be patient educators and not just program designers. Take the time to explain why you're making the training decisions you're making if they happen to ask. Share relevant research in accessible ways. Help them understand what appropriate development looks like at their child's age and at proper maturity level. So when you see warning signs of overtraining, burnout, injury risk, communicate those concerns directly and clearly with the parents, with empathy for the parents' investment and their goals for their child. Now, parents, your child's performance coach or trainer has expertise in these athletic development and that's valuable and worth respecting. So when they recommend approaches that seem to conflict with what the travel team coach is doing or asking, ask questions and try to understand the reasoning rather than to immediately dismiss us as coaches. Because recognize that good, high quality performance strength and conditioning based coaches for young athletes often doesn't look like what you might expect based on watching professional athletes or college programs or what you're seeing on majority of social media. Movement quality, fundamental skill development, and appropriate progression matters more than loading your kid with stupid heavy weights or doing professional style-based training programs. What the pros are doing is a waste of time for your kid. It may even be a waste of time for some of the pros off some of the stuff that I see. But that's not your framework. That's not what you want to go into thinking that your kid's going to get. Trust what your performance coach is doing if they've got the requisite to be trusted. Now, both coaches and parents need to keep the actual child at the center of the decision, right? This is around the kid. We're doing this for the kid. We do not want to let adult agenda dominate what the kid wants to do. If the kid doesn't want to do sports or that particular sport, don't make them do the damn sport, right? If they don't want to be on the travel ball team, don't make them do it. Now, I have said this before as well, that if a kid commits to a team or a sport for that season and they want to quit in the middle of it, I don't believe in that. Now, that's me as a parent speaking here, okay? This is my personal belief. You do not have to do this to your parent, obviously. I'm not going to tell you how to parent your kid. But for me personally, when my kid goes to enter a sport, he will finish that season. You're not quitting on your coach. You're not quitting on your teammates. There is something to be said about finishing what you start. And in today's society, everybody's able to just quit up and leave. If we look at current college sports and the transfer portal and the NIL thing, there's no loyalty anymore. And so I do not want my kid to have the belief that you can stop doing something just because it gets hard and you don't like it. If you made a commitment to somebody and you said, I'm going to be on this team and you made this team, we're going to take the money out of it too. Even if you as a parent pay for it, right? Like, well, I'm paying for my kid to be there, so I don't take him. I don't have to take him. Well, you should because you said you were going to, right? But the thing I'm getting at here is that we want the kid to have majority of the decision-making. I think it's great that you sit down and you have hard conversations and you try to explain, hey, Timmy, you want to be a better tennis player. We should do basketball and we should do track because they're going to make you faster and make you change direction and you have better hand-eye coordination and it's going to keep you healthier and it's going to be fun and you can make new friends. Like, there's all these great things that come from it. Yeah, maybe you're not hitting a tennis ball year-round, but at the end of the day, if you can explain how this might help Timmy be a better tennis player, then there might be something that they're willing to actually consider, or at least try, right? So it is a two-way street, but we want to make sure that, again, all the decision-making is centered around the child. Now, the child's physical health, the psychological well-being, the long-term athletic development, the overall growth as a person should guide the decisions about the training, the competition, and then the sports participation. When those priorities are clear and shared between the athlete, the coach, and the parent, you create an environment where young athletes can really, really thrive and really blossom and grow to not only be a great athlete, but be a great freaking person. Now, here's my final message to both coaches and parents, that the youth travel support system has significant problems. There are tons of problems, and I've touched on some of them here with this episode. And the research clearly shows that the current culture of early specialization, the year-round training, and the intense competitive pressure at the young ages is creating more injuries, more burnout, and not necessarily better long-term athletic outcomes. But the system is not going away anytime soon, at least it's not looking like it's going to, and the individual families and coaches can't fix the entire industry. But what you can do is make better decisions within this system. So parents, you can resist the pressure to specialize early, prioritize your child's health and well-being and enjoyment over the competitive outcomes, especially before high school. Maintain realistic expectations about college scholarships. Build strong partnerships with the coaches and the trainers that are working with your kid. Coaches, we can apply developmental science and our programming. We can communicate effectively with the parents about appropriate training. Even if you know other sport coaches and you can get them to buy into this as well, that's even better. We can create environments that support the psychological health and the intrinsic motivation side for these athletes and be willing to advocate for what's actually best for the young athlete when it conflicts with the travel sports culture. The research that we have is giving us some very clear guidance that multi-sport participation, appropriate recovery, emphasis on movement quality and fundamental athletic development, and psychological support for intrinsic-based motivation lead to better outcomes, not only in the athletics, also in everything outside of the athletics when it comes to school and social structures, and even when they go over to get jobs and be functioning human beings in the real world. So not just the better athletic performance, but the healthier, more resilient, more well-rounded young individual who can maintain their love for sports and their physical activity later on into that adulthood. Now, if you happen to find this episode valuable, do me a favor, share it with other coaches and parents in your network. Both groups can benefit and need to hear this information more. So leave a review of the podcast that you happen to listen to this on, whether it be Spotify, Apple, iTunes, you know, what have you, where you listen over on YouTube. All that not only helps the podcast, but helps it reach more individual people. And also let me know any other topics that you happen to want me to explore in the comment section of the YouTube video if you happen to be listening and or watching to this over on YouTube. We will have all the show notes and everything with all the research citations over in the show notes and all that kind of stuff. Now, for the coaches listening, I really appreciate you trying to spread the good word here. Keep training these kids smart and hard and coach with the long-term athletic development model in mind, and you're going to go on and do great things and know you've got the right mindset and you're thinking about the child first and foremost. If the parents listening, trust the developmental science and keep your child's well-being at the center. And for anyone else just happen to be listening, just happen to remember that we're all on the same team here when it comes to helping these young athletes thrive and be better athletes and be better people. So again, thanks for tuning in for today's episode. I really appreciate it. I know I really dove in deep to this. This is something that I'm incredibly passionate about, and I'm excited to kick 2026 off with this episode. I think it's something that needs to be talked about more. So again, share with anybody that you think would really appreciate it. If you happen to be listening, again, over on those streaming devices that you are, just again, leave that 5-star review, like, comment, share with friends. All that really helps me out. If you're on YouTube and you happen to be watching this and you're not subscribed, hit that subscribe button right to drop more episodes and more YouTube content on the weekly. And as always, thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you at the next episode.
Thanks for listening to Thirst for More podcast. Make sure you give us a follow on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere else you like to consume your podcast. You can also check us out on YouTube at The Smitley, where you'll find clips and lots of educational-based material for strength and conditioning and exercise science. You can also make sure you give me a follow on Instagram at bsmitley or at Team Thirst, which is my gym Instagram page. For any more future updates on episodes to come, you can make sure you follow me there. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you at the next episode.